Hi, I'm Jonathan Tanner. I'm the Media and Public Affairs Officer here at ODI, and we're here today to talk about the place of inequality in a post-2015 MDG framework. I'm joined by Alex Cobham, who is a research fellow at the Centre for Global Development Europe, Ricardo Fuentes-Nieva, the head of research at Oxfam, and Amanda Lenhart, research consultant for the Chronic Poverty Advisory Network. The question I want to kick off with is to ask, why is inequality important in societies? Isn't it a fact of life that some people do better than others, that there will always be a top and a bottom? Why is this a challenge that we're here at the event today discussing?
I'll give you two reasons why. One is that if we only care about the absolute progress or the absolute poverty of people at the bottom, then for any given level of national level progress, the more inequality you have, the further you have to go to get those people to some absolute minimum level. But the really fundamental point is the other one, which is that we know inequality doesn't just damage the people at the bottom, it damages whole societies. Conflict is more likely, sustained growth is less likely, a set of governance problems are more likely, and each generation of children is more likely to be intellectually weaker if they are born into societies with greater inequality. So there's so many reasons why this should be at the centre, not the periphery, not on the edge, not one more thing, but at the centre of the next development framework.
I'm Ricardo Fuentes from Oxfam, and I agree with your premise that we're different, and this is what I call the two sources of inequality. There is one source that we might call positive, which is the merit-based inequality, which is a consequence of our effort, our work, our responsibility, individual choices. But there is another source of inequality, which is the privilege-based inequality, and that's how privileged groups reproduce the access to opportunities, to education, to good jobs, to savings and financial services and things like that. And we're learning more and more on how to disentangle that. And it's very important for us if we want to give a fair chance to anyone born in a given society to make sure that the equality of opportunity is there and that we know how to reduce the privilege-based inequality.
Part of the reason why we need to look at inequality, particularly now, is that very recently we've been looking at measures of progress and looking at what we've been able to achieve over the last few, particularly decades, in human development outcomes or in income. But by looking at averages, we're looking at a slightly biased view of what we've been able to achieve. And only through looking at the inequitable distributions of our progress over this time can we really understand what these outcomes have been for particular groups and whether or not we are actually achieving progress for everyone. So without disaggregating the view that we take, we're missing the realities of a vast majority of people who are in the poorest of the poor.
For many people involved in discussing the post-2015 framework, a specific goal on inequality is one of their current goals. But if we get a goal on inequality, how are we going to measure progress against that? And I think there are competing ways that we could measure that progress. Alex, you've been looking at a comparability between a Palmer index and the Gini coefficient. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So the Palmer is a proposal that I and Andy Sumner of King's College have come up with, which is based on a discovery by Gabriel Palmer, a Chilean economist, who found that across countries at quite different income levels, the share of national income going to the fifth to the ninth decile is strikingly consistent. And on that basis, he argues that most of the politics of distribution are around the distribution between the top 10% and the bottom 40%. So we've taken that ratio and christened it the Palmer, and we're exploring the extent to which it's, in our view, potentially a more valuable measure to look at income or other economic inequality than is the Gini. In doing so, we're kind of revisiting some of the problems that others have found and finding new ones with the Gini. So, you know, the argument is not necessarily that the Gini should be dropped altogether, but as we say in the title of the paper, put back in its bottle, you know, put in an appropriate place alongside at least other measures rather than being the one thing we use to measure inequality.
Ricardo, the Palmer Index, are you a fan?
I like some of the characteristics of the Palmer. I've had conversations with Alex and Andy, and my view is that we need to be clear on what the Palmer measures, and I think it measures concentration of income more than inequality, because it doesn't take into account half of the population of a given group. But for measuring income concentration, it's a rather good measure, because you get a sense of how much the top of the distribution is getting relative to the bottom 40%. It's basically, that's the definition of it. And in a way, going to my previous conversation, probably the Palma is a better measure of the bad inequality, the privilege-based inequality, because it's focusing on that top 10%. So part of the things that I'm interested in studying is how, say, for instance, the concentration of income measured by the PALMA or by the top 10% is correlated with certain political outcomes or certain political processes, because that's the kind of thing that we need to understand. We need to understand how concentration of income and extreme inequality is affecting our way of life, our political processes, our society, and things like that. We know it does, but we don't know exactly what are the mechanisms, and this changes country by country. So in that sense, I think that the PALMA is a good addition to the discussion. That said, the PALMA is just an indicator. The MDGs include goals that are broader than that, and the PALMA could be an indicator of a given goal. The question is, what is the goal? And that's something that we need to discuss more. What is the goal that we need to tackle?
Amanda, what's your view?
I also like the PALMA for the lens that it gives us in looking at income distributions versus the Gini. It's much more responsive to the particular parts of inequality that we want to be concerned with from a policy point of view. So looking at the ends of the income distribution that are actually moving and where gains are being made and at whose expense that these are occurring. So certainly I think that the PALMA adds this dimension where the Gini coefficient doesn't. The dimension that I'm particularly interested in, though, is the idea of the bottom 40% being a group in and of themselves. And what we're interested in is particularly disaggregations below the 40%, because there are actually, in particular countries, certainly very much different experiences among whether it be the bottom 10%, the bottom 20%, or the bottom 40%. When we disaggregate at these levels, whether it be in income or relating income outcomes to human development outcomes, we see very different pictures for people in that distribution. So some recent research we've done has been comparing human development outcomes for the bottom 20% to the second 20%. And there is quite a reasonable gap between those outcomes within this distribution of the 40%. And actually, over time, we've seen those gaps increasing, that much of the progress that we can measure on reducing inequalities are actually, or in reducing poverty, are actually between the 20 to 40%. So my question is, how can we then take this measure and look within the distributions and within the ratios that are being measured?
Well, I think there's a lot of useful points there. And, you know, we certainly aren't arguing that the PALMA is perfect and that should be the end of the conversation. You know, we would see it as one of a number of measures that would be useful. I do think, though, that there certainly could be a standalone economic inequality goal designed around the PALMA. And indeed, Lars Engberg Pedersen from Copenhagen has put forward such a proposal already. And that's based around setting targets for countries to reduce their PALMA alongside, of course, other measures. But I think it's also worth thinking about the potential for the PALMA to look at other inequalities, so to think about inequalities in terms of, say, maternal mortality. You know, this is a ratio between two groups that does seem, from the kind of work we've been doing with household survey data, also to tell you quite a lot about overall progress in non-economic dimensions. So I think there's a direction of research there to explore. And in terms of policy measures, I think we're really just keen that, at the very least, there is an open conversation about whether the Gini is either appropriate at all or at least appropriate on its own, and we would think probably not to the latter at least.
And one of the things which is quite striking about the PALMA Index is that it sets the top and the bottom apart quite distinctly. And one of the kind of the history of development to date has been very much about absolute poverty and the world's poorest. And this index appears to bring into the equation the wealth of the richest. Is there a political difficulty or perhaps political risk in changing or framing the conversation so that it's around how rich are the richest and how poor are the poorest, whereas previously the question has been how poor are the poorest? Ricardo, do you have any thoughts on that?
It is true that terms of the debate have changed recently. The experience over the past 20 years, and probably until 5 years ago, was to focus on the bottom of the distribution in certain very influential groups, with the World Bank and the IMF particularly. That has changed, and it has changed because we understand more and we understand better what are the mechanisms that make societies weaker and more fragile when it comes to this disparity of incomes. And we see it on the financial crisis that we've experienced over the past 4 years since September 2008. When you look at how different groups have done after the crisis, we see that, say, for instance, in the U.S., most of the recovery was captured by the top 1%. And this is because they rigged the rules of the system. So it's very, I mean, it's very telling to this narrative that it is not because they work harder. It is because they're able to influence the political process. They pay a large amount of money on lobby to influence Congress. And at the end, they reap the benefits of that through the political system and the financial system. So it is important. I mean, whenever we're faced with shocks, and all societies are faced with shocks, if inequality is bigger, then the poor will and the bottom of the distribution will be more vulnerable, and the rich will be able to benefit of it.
So, Amanda, if we concentrate on the income of the richest as well as the poorest, do the poorest lose out as a result?
Well, I think when we look at a standalone goal on income inequality, we're necessarily looking at some kind of redistribution. And so whether or not we're highlighting the top end of that income distribution or not, necessarily we're talking about a shift within that. So I think, you know, comparing progress by monitoring to what extent those shifts go from which group to which, and so whether or not they're going from the bottom end of the distribution to the top or vice versa, I think we certainly need to be monitoring that as we go forward. But in terms of setting a goal, I think it's perhaps politically challenging to put the focus on this top 10%. And I think in terms of a standalone goal, we are saying that regardless. And so to highlight that is perhaps going to present a challenge. But in terms of what effects this might have on the poorest of the poor, I think from a policy perspective, what we need to be looking at is how interventions can have impacts on that group of people. And so this might require less focus on an examination of redistribution from the top, and instead looking at what individual measures can be taken from a policy perspective that actually allow marginalized groups, for example, from gaining traction from wider economic progress, so that through interventions themselves, these changes can happen without a politically sensitive redistribution campaign.
And Alex, are you expecting the Palmer Index to be well received in the world's wealthiest households?
Yes, I'm sure it'll be encouraging people to choke in their cornflakes. But there is a serious point here about accountability. If we look back at the MDGs and think about the ones where progress has been strong and where it's been weak, it's quite informative. So to take one where it's been weak, access to sanitation has been particularly poor, one might say shit, if I'm allowed to, whereas the gender equality in education has been relatively strong. And that's because gender equality set such a powerful norm that governments were both held to account for it, but also felt incentivized to demonstrate progress in a way that they simply didn't in terms of sanitation. Now, if we're thinking about a standalone income inequality goal, the question is what kind of target and indicators will promote that sort of accountability? It seems to me, as I said earlier, that I can't imagine a civil society campaign ever approaching policymakers and saying, you must reduce the Gini from 0.42 to 0.39 or the equivalent. Whereas pushing policymakers on the ratio of if the top 10% have four times the income of the bottom 40%, to encourage them to move that number towards three, strikes me as, you know, both something that civil society is likely to be mobilised by and that government will feel a responsibility to respond to. So I think part of this is political, and the simplicity, the clarity of the Palmer, I think makes it particularly attractive for that.
We've talked a lot about income inequality. The focus of the debate appears to be at the moment income inequality, but surely there are aspects we should be discussing, aren't there?
I think absolutely, and certainly the two are related and not always easily separable, because certainly, you know, a wider access to income is going to allow opportunities to other human development outcomes. So I think rather than perhaps stepping away from income inequality, we need to be looking more at the intersections between different inequalities and how they affect one another. So to what extent does being among the poorest 20 or 40% result in a disadvantaged outcome in, for example, education or healthcare? These things aren't necessarily unrelated. And beyond outcomes, we'd also be interested in looking at inequalities on a horizontal axis versus vertical inequalities. Whereas income looks at differences between individuals, vertical inequalities, horizontal inequalities consider more disadvantaged groups within a society. And so looking at how particular disadvantages, for example, being from a particular ethnic minority, being spatially disadvantaged within a country, or perhaps being a woman or an older person, how these overlapping disadvantages intersect to create deeper inequalities within society, and whether that be from an income perspective or from a human development.
What's your view on this, Ricardo?
No, of course, income inequality is just one dimension of what we should care about. And the question is, I very much agree, is what are the mechanisms that connect horizontal with vertical inequalities? Because we know they connect. So it's very often when you see someone with low education and poor health is also poor in terms of income. So we know, I mean, it's something so evident we shouldn't even be discussing it, but we don't know what's the direction. If it's poor education and poor health that drives to income poverty, or if it's what's the dynamic. And I think that's the kind of conversation we should be having before agreeing on specific goals. Say, what are the mechanisms that are perpetuating marginalization? And this marginalization is something that goes from vertical to horizontal and from horizontal to vertical. So I definitely agree that we should look at all the types of inequality, but more importantly, we should try and understand better how, say, and this is just one direction, how concentration of income actually leads to massive differences in health and massive differences in education, and how these perpetuate across generations.
And a final question for each of you. Let's fast forward a few years and hope that there was an inequality goal or an equality goal in the new Millennium Development Goal framework. What does all of this mean for the decisions that governments take? What should they be prioritising if they are keen to tackle inequality? Alex?
Thinking of income inequality, to begin with, it's clear that the tax system in so many countries needs a serious overhaul. For too long, governments have been encouraged, by not least by the International Monetary Fund, to take decisions about tax that were based on some idea of economic efficiency rather than political outcome, with the argument being that you could do your redistribution elsewhere. Now, in fact, what we've seen is that simply isn't the case, with the exception of some countries in Latin America that recently have begun to ramp up their transfer programs. The absence of redistribution in tax, in many cases a regressive tax system overall, contributes to the inequalities and their ongoing embeddedness. So that's the place to begin from a policy point of view. But I think I wouldn't want to separate out income inequality from the type of group inequalities that we've talked about. And that's, you know, we would say one other potential advantage of the PALMA is that it allows you to consider intersecting inequalities of an economic type with, for example, ethno-linguistic or gender, disability and so on types in a way that the Gini doesn't really lend itself to. So I think ideally over the next couple of years we'll see a consensus around a way in which each of these types of important inequalities can be framed in a consistent framework. And that in itself, I think, will be the starting place to drive governments to really focus across the whole range.
Okay, Amanda, how can we encourage governments to tackle inequality?
Well, I think beyond looking at specifically an issue related to income inequality and one looking at outcomes in health, education, nutrition, etc., is to look at the structural mechanisms that allow these inequalities to persist. And so this would not necessarily lend itself well to an international goal or an international indicator on reducing inequality. But one of the fundamental issues that need to be looked at within countries, at a country level, is what are the social, economic, and political processes that allow these inequalities to persist, and how can individual policies in particular sectors or addressing particular vulnerable groups within any given society, how can these be most effective in reducing some of the impacts of these structural inequalities? And also looking at how socially progressive, perhaps campaigns or policies themselves, can be used to start to break down some of these structural barriers that keep people in an equitable position, rather than propelling them through other means, is to look at how these can be propelled themselves, to look at a more sustainable outcome to reducing inequality that builds upon itself.
Yes, I think the issue of accountability is very important. And what I mean is, if governments are talking the discourse of equality of opportunity and all men are created equal, they need to walk that talk. And that's where we need to keep an eye on how governments are treating the marginalized groups, the vulnerable groups, and how they're reducing this social exclusion. So, because at the end, when we talk about inequality, either income or group-based inequality, what we care about is about social justice. This is the basic concept that we're discussing. And few governments would disagree that social justice is one of their goals. But at the same time, few governments would actually take the difficult decisions to achieve a more just and fair society. And that's what I think we should be moving towards.
Alex, Ricardo, Amanda, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this ODI podcast. For more resources and downloads from ODI, please visit our website at www.odi.org.uk.